The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So we're continuing our series on the five precepts this week. Last 2 weeks we've talked about not only the general context of ethics in our practice, but the first two precepts, including the precept for refraining from killing and refraining from taking what is not given. Tonight we'll talk about the precept around refraining from sexual misconduct. But before we get into that, I wanted to just check in and see if anybody working with the precepts last week had any questions, or if anything came up, any subtleties around the precepts came up that you're interested in talking about, or any questions about what we talked about, to open it up for a few minutes to see if there's anything to discuss about what you've been working with. Okay. So I wanted to start tonight, remind you about kind of the framework of the practice as a whole and how working with the precepts fits into that. And I want to do that by reminding you about the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are the kind of central or fundamental teaching of our practice. The truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So the whole direction of our practice is towards noticing suffering and seeing how we can let go of it or work to release it. And these precepts fit into that because they're about, at their heart, these precepts are really about cultivating skillful action. Action that leads us away from suffering and towards happiness. So these actions that these precepts guide us to fit into this framework of the Four Noble Truths of seeing suffering and understanding the cause of it and letting go of that cause. So this whole idea around knowing what leads us to suffering and knowing what leads us away from suffering is really the teaching of wisdom in this practice. Wisdom is about knowing what leads us away from suffering. And wisdom is about knowing how to avoid things that lead us into suffering. This is about skillful action, knowing what is skillful and unskillful. So the precepts work to support this understanding, to support this wisdom. And essentially, you know, I can kind of think of the Buddha saying, we know these things, if you engage in these actions, they're likely to lead you into suffering. So it's a good idea to try to avoid them. And so he was providing us with some guidelines for our cultivation of skillful action. But it really comes down to what leads us away from suffering. That's the whole context here. It's not about right and wrong or good and bad. It's really about what will ultimately make us happier people, what will lead to happiness in our lives, what will lead to harmony in our relationships. So that aspect of the precepts is cultivating this quality of wisdom. This quality of wisdom in our minds. I think that's a really beautiful recognition to make around this cultivation of these, working with these precepts. I talked a little bit last week about some other qualities that are cultivated as we engage in the precepts, and I'll just go talk about those a little bit now too. how these precepts work to support our practice as a whole. There's one list that the Buddha talks about. Maybe in the commentaries, but there's one common list called the paramis, or the perfections, these qualities, perfections of mind, qualities of mind that get cultivated as we engage in our practice. And there are 10 of them. And there are qualities of generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, kindness, resolve, and equanimity. And it is understood, at least in Asian countries, that the practice of these qualities, cultivating these paramis, is one of the main tasks of us in our daily life practice. So looking at these qualities, looking at these paramis and working with them in our daily life, noticing where they're present, where they're absent, what gets in their way. There's a whole lot of action that can happen in our daily lives around looking at these qualities. And I looked at this list, and right off the bat I could see how 9 of them are cultivated directly with the cultivation of these precepts. With working with these precepts, 9 of these paramis are directly impacted. The first 9. Generosity. I mentioned this some last week, that as we engage in the precepts, we offer the gift of fearlessness to those around us. So that's a form of generosity. Virtue. The precepts themselves are a form of cultivating this ethical conduct or virtuous conduct. Renunciation, because we sometimes need to let go of acting on things that we might otherwise do. Wisdom, which I just spoke about. Energy, because we have to engage our effort to look at what is skillful and non-skillful, and that is the definition of right effort in this practice, engaging in actions that lead us towards the wholesome, and letting go of actions that lead us towards the unwholesome. And that cultivates energy. Patience, because it's not always easy, and we have to just continue and come back over and over again to trying to work with all of these qualities, and the work with our own minds to let go of the desire and aversion. So patience. Truthfulness, cultivated directly in the precept of refraining from false speech, which we'll talk about next week. Resolve, because we again have to resolve over and over again. It's not something, the whole practice isn't something we just say one day, oh, I'm going to do this. We have to actually resolve over and over again. As we do our meditation practice, we have to resolve over and over again. Our mind goes away, we come back to the breath. That's a form of cultivating resolve, coming back over and over again. As we look at these precepts and work with the precepts, it's a similar thing. We need to keep coming back to them, reminding ourselves over and over again, this is what I'm working with. This is how I would like to function in the world. Kindness. The whole underpinning of the precepts is around non-harming and being kind to other people. The last one, equanimity, I think is cultivated, but perhaps a little less directly. That the equanimity is a balance of mind around our experience, a balance of mind around when we are suffering and when we are happy, so that we're not kind of swayed, our mind isn't swayed off balance as we engage in the practice. And I think this is cultivated Because as we engage in working with the precepts, we'll find times that we confront suffering in ourselves and others. And we need to bring some attention to that so that we don't get pulled off balance. So that one, I think, is cultivated, but perhaps a little less directly. So this engagement in working with the precepts has a lot of impact on our lives. It's not simply about, and I know I've been saying this all the other weeks as well, but I really want to impress upon you, it's not just about doing what the rules say. It's about engaging and looking at our experience and noticing the qualities that are cultivated as we work on this and notice what's let go of. Notice how it supports our movement away from suffering. So this third precept, refraining from sexual misconduct. So essentially in the suttas, the definition of this, and I'll read it to you, implies, states, refraining from adultery. And here is the sutta definition. Abandoning sensual misconduct, he abstains from sensual misconduct. He does not get sexually involved with those who are protected by their mothers, their fathers, their brothers, their sisters, their relatives, or their dhamma, those with husbands, those who entail punishments, or even those crowned with flowers by another man. So this is pretty culturally contextual, I think, this definition. It's fairly patriarchal, yes, and I read in, this definition really refers to men, and I read in the, in one text that I was looking at that the definition for women who are married is that they should refrain from sexual contact with any other men at all. And that is not actually what this says for men. You know, it gives you specific women that you should not engage with, but then courtesans, it doesn't mention them. They're not protected by others. They're not protected by their practice. They're not crowned with flowers by another man. So, you know, it's kind of got a double standard going here. But so I think we really need to look at the cultural context here. You know, what is it for us? And, you know, there's maybe differences for different people. You know, I know that some people may feel that, you know, there shouldn't be any sexual relationship outside of a committed relationship. Others might feel that marriage is necessary. For others, the commitment part is less necessary, I mean the actual committed relationship part, but monogamy is necessary. And for some people, the monogamy doesn't seem to necessarily be an issue as long as everybody involved is open and above board about their relationships. So looking at what makes sense to with our own culture. And one of the, there are two key things here I want to point to. And one is around non-harming. And I'll talk a lot about that because that underlies all the precepts, this consideration of non-harming. The other one is that in engaging in our world, we have to consider all the precepts. And if we're violating another precept in our actions, it's probably not such a good thing. So for instance, refraining from lying, which we'll talk about next week. As I was talking about this precept with Gil, he said, you know, it's pretty hard to have an affair without engaging in lying. So bringing, you know, the whole picture together. So, you know, maybe we think, oh, it's not going to hurt somebody if they don't know. You know, so not telling them is the way to go. But does that serve us, we need to look at how it serves us as well. Does it serve us? Because we are engaging in lying, perhaps. But really, the piece I really want to look at tonight is around this non-harming. And how do we look at that? How do we work with that? This really cuts through and gets us looking to where we might begin to uncover some delusion around how we engage in our actions. In my own history, a number of years ago, earlier in my life, I was involved with a man who up front told me that he would not be monogamous with me in our relationship. And I figured, okay, you know, as long as he's up front about it, you know, this is okay. And I went ahead and allowed myself to get into the relationship. Now, I'm not blaming him here, because he was very upfront about it. But it was harmful to me. It was extremely painful and very damaging to my own self-esteem and my own self-worth. Yet I kept going in the relationship. So, you know, we have to look at the non-harming side on both sides. You know, so suppose somebody is not lying about this, but are we being harmed? And I was, and I really should have remove myself from that relationship if he could not be monogamous with me. So, you know, even if you're upfront about it with somebody and they're engaged in the relationship with you, it may be harming them, even if they're continuing in the relationship. So it's a difficult area. So looking at this non-harming, there's one teaching that the Buddha gave on non-harming. And he gave this teaching to his 7-year-old son. It's really one of the first teachings he gave to his son. And I'll explore this with you because it's a beautiful teaching. It's easy enough for a child to understand. And yet it is very challenging. I mean, I'm amazed when I read this sutta, and I was talking to a friend about this at one point. I said, look at this sutta, look what he's telling his son to do. And look how hard this is. And my friend said, well, yes, but you understand that, because it's addressed to Venerable Rahula, who is his son, the Venerable Rahula. And my friend said, but Rahula was venerable at that point. And I said, Rahula was 7 years old at that point. So the teaching basically says, there's three parts to it. Anytime before you engage in an action, notice or check to see if it's going to harm yourself or another person. If it is, don't do it. Then it says, while you're going into the action, so you don't stop there, you know. So while you're engaged in an action, check and see if this is harming somebody else or yourself while you're engaged in the action. And if it is, stop doing it. And then he didn't stop there. He said, and then afterwards, you reflect on things you have done. Look back on what the consequences were. Did this cause harm for myself or another person? And if it did, then we need to somehow, you know, there's a couple of pieces here that the Buddha suggests making a confessing, essentially, telling a teacher how you have harmed somebody else, and also making the resolve that you would try to not do that in the future. So this is a very challenging teaching for us. It's a continual reflection. It's a continual cultivation of mindfulness around suffering, mindfulness around how our actions impact other people. Before we do something, while we're doing something, after we do something. And this is for any action of body, speech, or even mind. But at the end of this part, he says, if you know this action that I have done with the body does not lead to my own affliction or the affliction of others or the affliction of both, it was a wholesome bodily action with pleasant consequences, pleasant results, you can abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. So he reminds us to notice when we have engaged in skillful actions, when we're cultivating these wholesome qualities, to recognize them, to not simply let it go by us, but to actually kind of direct our attention and say, oh yes, I have been cultivating these wholesome or skillful qualities. So this is a challenging teaching. I mean, I certainly find it challenging to reflect continually on how I'm acting. It's not an easy teaching, but it's the underlying principle under all the precepts. And if we work with this teaching only and don't worry too much about the actual form of all the precepts, if we just work with this teaching, we will really begin to purify our conduct and begin to see how we impact other people. So this precept, working with this precept, cultivates the qualities of fidelity, peacefulness, and respect. Respect for other people. And we can think, too, about expanding this beyond the actual boundaries of adultery to just even taking care with our sexual energy. You know, this really goes against the grain of our culture. If you look through even the New York Times magazine, the ads are rife with sexuality, particularly of women. This it's used to sell, sex is used to sell, it's used to entertain. And do we want to engage in this for ourselves? How do we want to use our sexuality? We're sexual beings, so our sexual energy is pretty much there. But can we take care with it so we're not manipulating or harming people with how we're engaged? So looking at that, you know, exploring how we are engaging with other people with this energy. Is this energy part of our normal flow with people, and how are we engaged with it? And I'd like to teach you a little to explore this topic a little bit with you. I want to teach you a reflective practice that will now hopefully lead to some interesting thoughts. But before we do that, I just want to check and see, are there any questions or comments about what I've talked about so far?
So I had a question about the point you made about the responsibility you take, one should take when one is honest. Because I had a reaction to that, thinking that sounds codependent, or fill in the blank, because I probably am sensitive to the topic, because I'm just getting out of a 3-year relationship where I was extremely upfront about my inabilities to live with someone for now. You know, I mean, I just should just write it on my forehead, but, you know, just stay away 100 feet. So I've been very clear, and I think that should be okay, and I kept reinforcing it. And our relationship ended because my girlfriend wanted to move in, and nothing had changed in those 3 years. And so I felt that I had been honest, and it was hurt on both sides. So I needed to think about that, because I don't, it feels like unhealthy if I make a decision for you. Because if you make a decision for me and say I'm not going to do thus and such, because it'll hurt you, I find that a bit unhealthy, because it's my decision.
Right, and I agree with you, and I think, that's why I don't blame my boyfriend. You know, it's like, he told me up front, I engaged in it, and it was clearly harmful for me. So, but I guess the piece is that you might want to check into, not that you'd make a decision for them, but just looking at your own experience, if what you're doing, you see the harm, if you're seeing harm being caused in somebody, even if they want to continue, is that something you want to continue to engage in? To look at that piece of it. And you may want to explore that edge. And it sounds like it's something like that happened when she wanted to move in. It's kind of like, I don't know whose decision it was, but it sounds like there was a decision made that things haven't changed, so let's not go there. Let's not take it that step.
Mm-hmm. But you're right. I mean, at that edge, and exploring that edge is a good way to put it, because it's not always black and white.
It's not.
Black and white. I don't like that middle. And it is that middle where I can take responsibility to see that over the course of a few years, that it's been uncomfortable for me too, but there was a point at which, I could see the pain. But then I think it's not healthy to make a choice for someone else. So it becomes a little complicated.
It does become complicated. But again, you're looking at it, not you're making the choice for them, but you're making it for you.
Yeah.
I don't want to engage in this relationship where this person is being harmed. It's not that you're saying, you shouldn't be in this relationship. It's, I don't want to be engaged in this. And that's the way to really look at it.
Yeah,
yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Oops, okay. And then after you can pass it over to him.
Yeah. One thing I noticed in the sutta that you're talking about is the afterward part, there's nothing about reparation or amends. And
there,
that surprised me.
There is. I mentioned that he says, actually amends. I don't know. Maybe, let's see if it says anything about amends.
It says confess and don't do it again.
Confess. Having confessed, you should undertake restraint in the future. Yeah, I mean, amends, I think, it may be a part of what the confession reveals needs to happen. But yeah, it's not in here, which is interesting. Sometimes unskillful actions actually don't need amends. Sometimes they do, but sometimes they don't. So that's just one thing to look at. But you're right. I mean, it's something I think we do need to look at in our working with the precepts is the making amends and how we do that. And I'll talk some more about that, I think, in a couple of weeks.
excuse me. In reflecting before, during, and after sexual pursuits or romance or whatever, I never would have fathered any children at all. I never would have involved myself with the women that I've known. I was deluded to begin with, so were they. I thought they were such and such, and they thought I was woo-hoo. I wasn't. They weren't. So it all begins with delusion. Diluted in the beginning, the middle, and then the end. And I recall something my ex-wife said just as we were parted. You said you loved me. You were lying. And for the life of me, I didn't know that. I know there are various other forms of sexuality that are so malicious and vile that they, you know, we know them all too well. And I certainly, by all means, should, you know, abstain from even going. But our own attempts at romance, attempts at so-called relationships, of expressing our so-called sexual energy. Well, all I can say is I was deluded, and I still suspect that, as I recall several women I've met in the last year or so, that the delusion is ongoing.
I expect it probably is, because delusion runs very deep in us. But, you know, when your wife said that you were lying, and you said you didn't know that you were lying, it was a form of delusion, essentially, that was going on. But, you know, we can't really, we have to work with whatever level we're at. You know, we have to work from where we are. So being as careful as we can be, given our minds as they are, and noticing as we engage. I mean, basically, this is like, it's a guide for us through our lives, you know, what's skillful, what's unskillful. And we learn, hopefully, as we go, by looking at how things impact us and other people, and taking it in with mindfulness. The mindfulness is really the key. The mindfulness is what will undercut the delusion over time. As we notice when we engage with people that something causes suffering, if we're mindful of that, we feel the suffering of it, not only for ourselves but for other people. And that undercuts the delusion that led to the action in the first place. So it's the engagement with the with our minds, with how we're functioning, with the non-harming, with looking at how our actions impact people, that will slowly, over time, undercut that delusion. And that's all that we can do. You know, we can't undercut the delusion all at once and just say, okay. And we can't stop acting either, right? I mean, we have to do things. And we're going to act out of delusion. We haven't got much choice because we're acting and delusion is present. But we can notice how our actions impact ourselves and others, and pay attention to the consequences. And that will slowly, slowly guide us out of that delusion and towards awakeness.
So this is a juicy topic. It seems to me that the more you have the other individual's best interest at heart, the less problems you'll have as far as misconduct or doing things that you don't want to set off some bad karma going down the road. And it's, you know, we can rut around in sort of sexual pleasure. It's a lot of fun, but we do have the capacity to love and to have another person's interest at heart. And the more you kind of, the more your own interests recede, the more you're able to see what others might need or not need, as the case may be. And so it's kind of, you know, relationships. Both individuals have a responsibility of either accepting or rejecting what's going on, and hopefully delusion doesn't come into play.
It will.
Yeah. Best you can. Anyway, that came to mind.
Yeah. Now it's I think we need to be balanced about the idea of taking care of others or having another's best interest at heart and our own best interest at heart. I think we need to be really balanced about that. You know, there's actually one teaching. It's called the Acrobat Sutta, where the it's an analogy where there's a pair of acrobats practicing together, and you know they depend on each other to be safe, because they each need to do their part properly in order for them to perform together properly, kind of in a balancing act. I think one is balanced on top of the other or something. And one of them says to the other, I'll watch out for you and you watch out for me, and in that way we'll be safe. And the other one said, no, I need to watch out for myself and you need to watch out for yourself, and in that way we'll be safe. So, you know, we really need to take care that we aren't overthrowing our own looking after ourselves for another, so that it's balanced.
I would agree, but that doesn't seem to be a problem in society.
I'm not. Well, I mean, look at it in your own life. Yeah, look at it in your own life. That's really where we can begin here, you know, in addressing our own. And this, you know, this is like, we can't really fix society without doing the work ourselves. So that's a good place where doing it in our own lives is where it's really at. Now, I want to have enough time to do this this reflective practice with you. So let's stop on the questions for a second. And so this practice is a really interesting way to bring a meditative reflection to questions or to things we want to think about or explore in our lives. Ajahn Amaro taught me this practice. He is one of the abbots of the Abhayagiri Monastery up in Ukiah. And it's a beautiful practice and one that I love for daily life practice. So I'm going to have us reflect on this precept tonight, but it's broader than just reflecting on even the precepts. We can use it to reflect on using a meditative approach to reflect on questions or decisions that we need to make in our life. So it's a very broad technique, and it's a useful practice for our daily lives, and I like to offer it to people. And this seemed like a good opportunity to offer you this practice. So the practice is basically to start with a couple of minutes of silent meditation, to let yourself settle into your bodies, into the present moment, and to just get the mind a little bit quiet. And then in terms of doing this on your own, if you work with it on your own, before you go into the meditation, and at home I'd recommend you'd maybe do 5 minutes or 10 minutes of meditation before you drop the question into your meditation. Before you go into the meditation, pick a question you want to explore. Have it phrased in your mind already before you go into the meditation, so that you don't have to spend time thinking about what you want to reflect on once your mind is already settled. And then once you're settled in meditation for a while, after about 5 minutes or 10 minutes or so, bring the question up in your mind. And then don't think about it in a normal way. Simply go back to your experience and notice what is happening for you. Where is there bodily tension, or what's bubbling up? What thoughts are bubbling up? What emotions are bubbling up? Just, there may be images, there may be moods, there may be all kinds of things that bubble up. And then just let go of them, notice them, take note of them, let go of them, and then come back to the silence. Come back to the question again. And see what else bubbles up. There may be something new that comes up. So it's not a form of thinking. It's really about allowing the question to impact the silence and notice what kind of ripples are created in there. It's kind of like you get a smooth pond. You allow the mind to become kind of smooth, and then you drop a stone in. and notice what the ripples of that stone are. So you're noticing the ripples of the question. So we'll do this for a few minutes here, but I'll be the one to pick the question for you. So you don't have to worry about thinking about the question. And actually, I'm going to start with offering you first a word to reflect on, to see how the word, the single word, impacts you. And then after another few minutes, I'll give you a question to reflect on, and then a second question. So we'll do this for about 10 minutes or so. So start by letting yourself settle into your body, coming in and relaxing, connecting with the breathing. And after a few minutes of the settle, of letting you settle, I'll offer you some words for reflection. Peacefulness. How do I use my sexual energy? Are there ways I can be more careful with my sexual energy? Anybody willing to share anything about what they experienced?
It just occurred to me when you said, is there any way I could be more careful with my sexual energy? That for women in particular, we might be a little too careful. So there's another side to that coin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think it was a little, no offense, just kind of generalizing.
Say more.
I have the opposite problem where I'm too careful, and that comes out of fear.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's something that a lot of women share, is that. So that's something that also needs to sort of be looked at as well in this particular practice is, yes, there's misconduct, but there's also misconduct towards ourselves.
Right.
And how we don't use our sexual energy in a good, positive way for ourselves. So I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, that's definitely, thank you for bringing that up. We do have to... we're talking about the precepts here, so we're kind of biased in that way. But yes, there are positive and wholesome ways to use our sexual energy. And if we're repressing it, or if we're fearful, if we're suffering around it, that needs to be looked at and explored. Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly easier in 61.
Please use the microphone.
My conservative was on the second round.
Start over.
And it is at
like 31.
So you said it's easier at 61 to be more careful than at 31.
I mean, it's like two. Now I'm here in class, all these years later when I should have been in, a long time ago. Now the damage has been done. Now I have regret. And, but now I also have this advanced age to dissipate and calm.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it refreshing somewhat. I can see and sense, problems that no longer arise.
Yes, simply because you've aged.
Exactly.
And part of that process isn't so much, it isn't completely just the body. It part of it is the wisdom that comes with aging. And Gil sometimes says that the practice of mindfulness is accelerated aging, that we learn more quickly from our experience. So some of it has to do with the reduction of hormones and that kind of thing, but some of it is also the wisdom that comes through simply living through things over and over again. And the mindfulness is kind of like the living through things and paying attention to it as we do it. So you're right, you're absolutely right, that the aging process definitely brings wisdom. But as Gil says, we can accelerate it. Mindfulness accelerates our aging.
This is actually an interesting topic because this came up with one of the older men I work with this week. I was in his office talking about some of my concerns about being a woman in my field and in finance. And to really succeed at the very top levels, I actually just have concerns that as a woman, you're asking people, mostly people who are not women, to relate to you at a very, very personal level, because it ultimately is a relationship business. And that I just have concerns that I would be able to develop those relationships. And we said, you know, we came to the agreement, we have a very open relationship about things that I do that are sort of girl-like, that sometimes hurt me in sort of, you know, boardroom situations or things like that. One of the things he brought up is how I dress, and I'll tend to wear like wrap dresses and high heels, and you know, I have, you know, legs showing and things like that. And he was like, I'm just going to throw it out there, something to address that you need to think about. And I'm struggling with it because on the one hand, I cherish being a woman and being expressive, and or we're sort of blessed to live in a great climate and also where there is no dress code. But he basically said, pantsuit. And it seems sort of silly, but it's related to much larger issues about how you're how much you want to be perceived as a woman. And he was talking out of both sides of his mouth, because he was also saying, as a woman at those very senior levels, if you can get there, you're very differentiated.
You're going to?
You're very differentiated. Because they're relatively few.
Uh-huh, right.
So I would like to know what you think.
You know, that's an interesting one, because it is more about perception. And it's, you know, it's like looking at what has to happen for you to accomplish what you want to accomplish. You know, what's skillful for you to accomplish what you want to accomplish. So if wearing certain kinds of clothes is going to get in your way of what you want to accomplish, you might look at how that works. On the other hand, you can also, you know, I don't actually think that the clothes actually makes as much of a difference as your demeanor, you know. So you could play with how you are presenting yourself and kind of see what impacts the situation. You know, really being mindful of what facilitates the relationships and what gets in the way, so that you know, you can make those choices for yourself. But you know, it's we live in certain cultures. You know, we definitely, that world is its own culture and sounds like it's very male. You know, it's this is again way beyond the precept. You know, we're not talking about the precept here, but sometimes as women we have to do what we can, you know, to or kind of fit in to a world until we can change it from within. Like, I think that's what you were saying, was that when you, if you can get to a higher level, then you can start to try to change it, essentially. But it's hard to change it from the bottom. You know, it's an interesting question. But again, look at for yourself. You know, not because he said you should do this or shouldn't do that. You know, he's giving you feedback that it impacts him that way, and maybe he knows that it impacts other people that way too. But look for yourself. You know, experiment. You know, when you wear a dress with high heels, how does that influence your reactions? How are people relating to you? Are they relating to you more sexually? Or is that the only way they're looking at you? When you go in more conservative clothes, does that impact how they're relating to you? So you use the mindfulness to notice what the impact is and make your choices based on what your goals are. Does that make sense? So we need to stop. I wanted to just check in with you because I was thinking next week of offering to teach you the chanting of the precepts in Pali, if there's an interest in that. So I'd like a kind of a show of hands of people who are interested in this. There's a few. Yeah, I was thinking of just doing it kind of at the end so that it wouldn't be like the whole thing. So okay, I'll do that at the end, and I'll bring the handout so that you can know them. And then to just this week, look at this question of how we engage sexually in the world and where it leads towards harming, suffering, and where it leads away from suffering. So thank you.